From the MPBN studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The North Woods of Maine is quintessential forest land, abundant trees and wildlife, prime land for hunting and fishing and lumber. It is this land that's the subject of vigorous debate. Entrepreneur Roxanne Quimby wants to donate more than 87,000 acres of this land and to have it designated a national monument. Supporters say it will boost tourism in the region. Opponents say the national designation will restrict industry growth and will hinder local residents' use of the land. A field hearing in East Millinocket yesterday aired some of these concerns. We'll talk about the pros and cons of this debate. With me in the studio, Lucas St. Clair is an outdoorsman and son of Roxanne Quimby. He's president of Elliottsville Plantation, Inc., the foundation that manages the land in question. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Charles Prey is a Millinocket town councillor and former president of the Maine Senate. Thank you both for joining us today. As always, we want to hear from you as well. What do you think should be done with this parcel of land in the North Woods? Our number is 800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. First, we turn to Maine Public Radio's Susan Sharon, who was in the Millinocket region yesterday covering a number of public events around this issue. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Keith.
So let's hear first about the congressional field hearing at the East Millinocket town office, which, as you reported, was hosted by two Republican members of the House Natural Resources Committee and Maine's Bruce Poliquin, who have all made it clear that they don't favor a national monument.
That's right. The members of the House Natural Resources Committee, Congressman Rob Bishop, he's a Republican from Utah, and Congressman Westerman, a Republican from Arkansas, came at the request of Maine Congressman Bruce Poliquin. They had arranged ahead of time to invite people to testify at this congressional field hearing. And the people who came were mostly local residents, although they did include the executive director of the Maine Snowmobile Association and the executive director of the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine. But they were all opponents of the national park or national monument. The panel said they had reached out to two supporters of the national monument, including Lucas St. Clair, who is from Elliottsville Plantation, Inc., the nonprofit that wants to donate the land for the monument, and to another local businessman. But both St. Clair and Matthew Polstein said they just didn't think the forum was appropriate. They weren't invited until after the panel got criticism for not reaching out to them in the first place. And they didn't think that 5 minutes was enough time for them to explain the proposal and answer really all the questions there are to discuss about it. It's complicated.
Now, after that hearing, Republican Congressman Bruce Poliquin stayed in that same venue and held an open forum on the issue. And to the surprise of some, a lot of supporters actually turned out for that event, which went for nearly 4 hours.
That's right. In the case of Bruce Poliquin's forum, you didn't need to be invited to come. And so people from surrounding communities came. Some of them were wearing T-shirts. There were some opponents. I mean, this is a divided issue. But what was surprising is that by the end of the evening, after several hours, there had been something like more than 45 people who testified in support of the National Monument or National Park and about a dozen against. And this is something that, you know, I don't think we have seen too often at the recent event involving Senator King and National Park Service Director Jarvis, who were in East Millinocket a couple of weeks ago. There were local town officials who were invited, and then it eventually opened up into more of a public forum. But that was mostly opposition.
Now, locally, residents have voted several times against a national park proposal for the region. That strategy has now shifted to asking the president to designate a national monument instead. Do we have any sense of where public opinion on this issue is now in the Katahdin region?
Well, it's difficult to know. You will often hear people talk about how divisive an issue this is. And I've even had some people say, you know, it divides families in some cases. You will often hear people say, from the business community, that they are reluctant to talk about their support for a national park or monument because they're worried about some kind of negative response from their customers. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago when I was there to do a story, I went into a business on the main street in Millinocket and tried to speak to a businesswoman. And she said, you know, I really just don't feel comfortable talking to you on tape. I don't want to give my name because I do support it, but I worry about a backlash. But yesterday, it really did seem like there was a sort of a turning of the tide where you had more people feeling comfortable that they could say they support this in a group. And in fact, at the close of the session, a Millinocket town councilor who previously has been sort of neutral on this whole idea said he came out and was coming out in favor of the national monument.
Maine Public Radio's Susan Sharon, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So, Lucas St. Clair, why do you and your mother want to give this land to the federal government along with the $40 million to maintain and preserve it?
Well, to begin with, it's a spectacular place. You know, it's just absolutely beautiful. It has had over the last 10,000 years very significant cultural and geological significance, and there's amazing waterfalls, and just the rivers are gorgeous and all of that. It's just a phenomenal place to be able to share with Americans and visitors from other countries as well. But beyond that, you know, our conservation goals have been achieved. It's in a foundation. The land is owned by a foundation that I run, and our mission is to conserve land. So in that sense, it's done. But when we think about what can be done beyond that and how conservation could potentially help the economy, we looked at how national parks have done so in just about every case around the country. And you know, I grew up in this region, and it's a place that has really fallen on some tough times. So we think we've been thinking a lot about what we can do from an economic standpoint. So that's really been a driving force as of late to try to revitalize and diversify the economy of the Katahdin region.
Charles Spray, why do you and others oppose this idea?
Well, my opposition basically comes because I'll agree with some of what Lucas has said, that it is a very special area. But specifically in reference to the original proposal of a national park, we need to remember that this started off with a proposal for a $3.2 million, not the current proposal that's here by them, but obviously Ms. Quimby supported the restore efforts to designate 3.2 million acres and preserve that. Afterwards, Ms. Quimby left that group and proposed the 150,000 acres, and now we're down to the 88,000 acres that they actually own. Of the 150,000, they did not own that acreage, so we're now down to where we are. It's kind of a moving target that's been going along. But I could probably name several dozens of places in Maine that would have all the same qualities that this particular acreage of land. This was land that was basically available. A lot of it had been cut over already, and Ms. Quimby, in her desire, purchased land that would fulfill what her quest was. They never really sold it to the local communities to start with, or the local people. And of course, I think a lot of that was because many of them felt that this is a toehold to go back to the restore proposal. As a matter of fact, there are several studies that advocated starting off with a small proposal, get your foot in the door, and then expand it to the additional lands. Let's stop for a minute. I was a co-sponsor of the Lands for Maine's Future program. I advocated and assisted in a number of land conservation easements over the years. I serve on the land, Unorganized Territories Land Use Planning Commission, which is set by state statute and regulations and rules as to how the unorganized territories will be protected and preserved for future generations. So this isn't necessarily a question about conservation. And as Lucas just said, they've achieved their conservation goal, so that land is somewhat protected. I've had many lives. I've also spent 58 years in the tourist business in the unorganized territory, running my parents first and then my wife and I for 58 years, a set of sporting camps and a small country store well into the unorganized territory. in a diagonal direction between Greenville and Millinocket, about 42 miles from both communities. So I appreciate the outdoors and the wilderness. We've had sporting, we had individuals coming and staying with us for close to 40 years who enjoyed the hunting and fishing of the backcountry of Maine and appreciated the value and the resources that we had. And of course, that was all through a working forest that existed. And I think that that model and the model that Maine has with the Lands for Maine's Future and a number of other things has done a terrific job in protecting and preserving the resources so that Maine people could and individuals from away could use it economic fashion.
Are you saying that you have opponents have said if you make this a monument, that will place restrictions on the use of the land and will affect businesses? Is that one of the arguments?
Well, there is some truth to that, and obviously we're trying to deal with since the shutdown of the paper industry close to a decade ago in Millinocket and more recently in East Millinocket. Look, we recognize the paper industry is gone. These are events that happen throughout the economy about every 75 years. We saw it happen with the shoe industry and the textile industry leaving the state. And we need to move on to a new era. And I think tourism, the Millinocket Town Council, and I believe that the 70 percentile of the local voters who have voted in multiple referendums opposing the park supports advocating and promoting tourism. There's a question, though, in reference to what type of restrictions and oversight comes when you have the federal government involved in this. Now, yep. I've also had another part of my life, to give a kind of a background in part where I come from, not that I totally agree with all of those who oppose it. I'm not necessarily opposed to the federal government. I am concerned about the process that's taking place here. But I also served in the federal government in both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration, where I dealt with it as a federal agency in dealing with state governments and local legislators and communities, both through the U.S. Department of Energy and in the Clinton administration and the Nuclear Security Administration and the Obama administration. And when we go out and deal with local communities and states, our responsibility and obligation is the federal national guidelines that are given to us. We really can't give that much consideration and concern for what local communities and states have in some of these areas. Now, I know that Director Jarvis spoke about how open they are to all these things, but they're not really advisory. Or I guess I could say that they're advisory at best, but the feds can do whatever they want to.
Yeah. Let's let Lucas St. Clair respond. There's a lot in there, and I appreciate the background, Charlie Prey, and your connection to the federal government as well. But I guess how would you respond in general, Lucas St. Clair, to the list of concerns raised by opponents?
Sure. I think in your lead and talking about the turning of the tide that people saw in East Millinocket yesterday, and then to Charlie's point that to him it seems like it's been a moving proposal with that's changed, and it has certainly evolved. It's changed significantly even in the 5 years that I've worked on this, and it's changed because I've spent the last 5 years in the Katahdin region having conversations with anyone who would listen. It was stakeholders, opinion leaders. I sat in people's living rooms and on and on and on, and that feedback has shaped the proposal. And now as people are learning exactly what it is and there's a plan, they're supportive. And so I'm not exactly sure what restrictions people are concerned about. There's restrictions on the land now. Certainly, there's a lot of access. And national parks are created by the Organic Act, 1916 Organic Act. And the heart of that legislation is to conserve unimpaired for future generations. It says that these parks and these places are set aside for the people. And I think that's a profound consideration when we think about this landscape and the benefits of it.
And you would make a case that there's a positive economic impact from tourism, from visitors, et cetera, that would actually bolster the local economy that's struggling with the decline of the forest products business.
Absolutely. I mean, the economy or the population of the Katahdin region is half of what it was a decade ago. The population is continuing to to get smaller. And we don't have to look any farther than Acadia National Park, just 2 hours away from the Katahdin region. And the $300 million that are spent there every year by tourists and the 2.7 million people that came there last year, I mean, it's astounding how it affects those communities in a positive way.
Charlie Pray, do you and other opponents doubt the positive economic potential of a national monument?
Well, first of all, the National Park Program, and then, of course, in turn, the National Monument. When Ellisville Plantation hired a consulting firm to advocate and promote and show examples of how the other national parks had helped local economies is very telling in many ways, particularly when you get into the details of it. Most of those have a million people within an hour's drive of them. And, of course, this area of Maine, you're probably 3.5 to 4 hours away from a million people. So it's kind of hard to compare as to how that's going to impact economically. As I said, the areas all support tourism and the promotion and expansion of tourism. But tourism is a low-income industry other than the proprietors of businesses. Most of their employees are minimum wage or slightly above minimum wage. So we're going to go from an industrial-based area that still has the power resources. Why that location was chosen for construction of Great Northern Paper. The hydro system is there. The energy, the cheap energy, produced at less than 2 cents a kilowatt that now gets shipped throughout New England could be used as it was originally to hire thousands of people in some fashion. There's not going to be another paper industry. There's not going to be another employer that comes in that's going to hire 4,000 people like the paper industry did 50, 70, 80 years ago. The question is, I think the community clearly wants a diverse economy. They want tourism to be part of it, and they want some type of economic development greater than that diversifies their economy. But let me go back to one thing that Lucas said in reference to the population and how a park would help. I did two reapportionments when I was in the state legislature, so I do follow population trends and so forth. And I'd have to say that what's happened in the Katahdin region is very similar to what's happened along Maine coast as well. The population has been shifting. It's mostly non-residents that own the prime properties in those areas, and the general population has either moved inland off in the ocean where they can afford to live, or they have totally left the area because of the rest of the economy that's happening in Maine. You cannot go to Bar Harbor and say that they've had a great growth in population because Acadia has been there. A lot of their employees come in during the summer from away. There's even a fair amount of foreign employment that takes place. So there's a lot of concerns as to what impact, and seemingly, again, back to the idea that this has been constantly changing. For example, a number of municipal officials have asked kind of where's the entrances and exits to this proposal, even if it's a proposal. And they've been very reluctant to specify any type of clarity on that.
Okay,
that people could then make an assessment as to whether it would be an economic advantage or not.
Okay, and we'll take that up after a quick break, and we want to hear from you as well. We're talking about this proposal to designate a national monument in the Katahdin region. The number to join the conversation is 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, the tragic misunderstanding that destroyed a young man's life.
They told me and my friend to put our hands on the wall. And I just thought it was a search. Yeah, don't worry about it. You're just going to go to precinct. We just want to figure out some things. Most likely you're going to go home. But it didn't. I never went home.
The story of Kalief Browder. That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And you can tune in for the New Yorker Radio Hour Saturday afternoon at 3 or Sunday evening at 11. The new MPBN app for iPhones, iPads, and Android is now available. The new MPBN app will let you easily listen live to both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical channels, and also watch and listen on demand to many of our television and radio programs, including reading and listening to our individual news stories. You can easily find the new MPBN app in both the Apple App Store and in the Google Play Store, and it's free.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the future of the North Woods. With me in our studio, Lucas St. Clair, the leading proponent for the National Monument designation. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Charles Prey, Millinocket Town Councilor, and an opponent of the proposed designation. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, Lucas, Charlie was pointing out that this has been a bit of a changing, morphing proposal, even to the details of where the entrance and would be in relation to the towns. What is the vision for that?
Well, there's a general management plan that will go into place after the proclamation would be signed by the president. And it's that point where local officials, the state, the Department of Transportation, the Park Service, the donors would all get together and identify where the best access points are. We obviously want to work with all the other landowners around us to keep from any interactions with logging trucks and make sure that efficient transportation of timber is a priority. The most straightforward access point is from the east. So this property is to the east of Baxter State Park, borders Baxter State Park on the east. And the most direct access point is to drive to the Patton exit on I-95 and then drive a few miles in and access it from the town of Patton.
So how far away from Millinocket and East Millinocket would that be?
It's about 45 minutes an hour from Patton and about a little less than that to East Millinocket. Millinocket's sort of out of the way. It's really on the way into Baxter State Park and not into the way of the proposed national monument.
Right. So Charlie, comment briefly before we go on to the phones here about the proximity of this proposal, and if the entrance were off the Patton exit, how would that affect Millinocket and East Millinocket directly?
I think it would have very little impact in reference to a flow of economic traffic. There have been some who have advocated that if you had this designated as a monument or a national park, the economic study was done on the idea that it would be a national park, not a national monument. But they were suggesting somewhere between a quarter of a million people to 325,000, I believe, was what the number was. First of all, Baxter Park itself limits the number of people that can go to it, so I don't see it really increasing amount of traffic into Baxter Park. They have a restriction somewhere of day use, how many people do they allow in on any particular day. So that would basically not be anything that would significantly help that community. It's also the question of a change of life for a lot of people, and a lot of people always are resistant to change. A lot of people who have stayed in the region or area, they stay because of the quality of life that's there, and they are concerned that a quarter of a million people might change their quality of life, kind of a Quimby world, Wally world type of alternative to what they've chosen for a lifestyle.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll go to Millinocket first and to John. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
You were at the hearing in East Millinocket yesterday?
Yes, I was. The meeting was really positive overall, I think, and a lot of people really finally, I think, had the nerve to come out and kind of band together and really express their views on and their interest in having the park. And it was nice to have Representative Poliquin there to hear all those voices.
And what's your take on public opinion locally?
Well, I think everyone will agree it's been split. At least on the surface, it appears to be split. But you know, if you're in the community like we are, you see that. You know, there are a lot of people who really don't dare to speak up. I was hoping to just address quickly one of the points that was made by, it actually became part of the official congressional record in the testimony introduced by Steve Stanley, who said there are legitimate questions around whether the proposal would even bring the suggested number of tourists to the region each year. And, you know, to me, the real question here is how are we going to rebuild this this economy. And people are talking about, well, where's the plan for the park? But what a lot of us are thinking here is, where's the plan for economic development? We know that tourism is, I mean, we know that manufacturing is struggling. We know that the paper has really struggled, and obviously the mills are closing, and we have to do something. And this is low-hanging fruit. This is something tourism, you know, people don't know how incredible this region is. And it's not just the area that the monument is being proposed in. It's the entire region up here. There are waterfalls. There's the mountain. There are the two of the best rivers in Maine and huge, beautiful, wonderful lakes, islands, the whole nine yards. And a lot of us believe that the tourism thing is the quickest, easiest thing we can do to really drive traffic here. And obviously, traffic will instantly, you know, fix the economy here.
All right. Charlie Prey?
John's originally from Aroostook, so he knows that part of Maine and has settled in the Medway community and has a business in Millinocket, and we're glad to have him come into the area and try to help us grow the economy. He's been a big advocate for the community to do things, and I'd like to just compliment him on those things. But even the park plan is several years away. This isn't necessarily just low-hanging fruit. It's the easy thing to do. And if you're going to, I said originally that part of my opposition is I don't think that it is that unique, special type of thing. You go anywhere around Baxter Park, you go north or you go west of the park, you go south of the park, you have that same spectacular vista. Because basically most of the promotion is this view of Katahdin and the view of the East Branch, which are already protected. They've been protected by Maine. We talked about the conservation goals, the Lands for Maine's Future. The state itself is one of the leading states in the nation, if not the leading state in the nation, of protecting and preserving the wildlands, the unorganized territory, the working forest, whatever you want to call that. But it's going to be several years off, even with the gift from Ms. Quimby of the $20 million, which would be basically, I think, used to establish the facility inside the park. We'd still have to expand the infrastructure, the road systems and whatnot, to handle the flow of traffic that's being estimated. If the idea that a national monument or a national park is an economic development tool, then we should have seven of them in all seven northern counties in Maine, because each and every one of them could use an economic boost. Like some of these people think that 250,000 people are going to come and visit the area because of it.
You made a couple of references so far to the sort of this idea that this land is, while beautiful, is nothing unusual, I guess, in the context of the North Woods. And monuments, Lucas St. Clair, have a list of criteria to qualify. You're convinced that this is unique land and deserving of monumental status?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been documented, and it's over and over and over, and then verified by the Park Service director just 2 weeks ago. There are so many incredibly special things that have happened here from a historic standpoint, and it's also just vast beauty. I mean, it's like going to Acadia and saying Acadia just advertises their view of the ocean. You know, it's like, yeah, it's really nice. The view of Katahdin is quite spectacular from this place. I would argue one of the most spectacular views of Katahdin is from the east side where I was yesterday. And, you know, to Charlie's point, if it's going to take a couple of years to realize the economic benefits, then we should start as soon as possible. Right? The sooner we get together and start working on this, the better. And when you think about roads being built and visitors centers being built, people have to do those jobs. People have to build those roads and build those trails and build those visitor centers. And it's, you know, it's additive to an economy that does not have anything being added to it right now.
What are the historical events that you're referring to?
Well, certainly Teddy Roosevelt had his real epiphany in the woods of the Wissahickon Valley. In 1919, on his deathbed, he wrote a essay called "My Debt to Maine" as a celebration of the 100th anniversary of the state, and wrote about his time in along the East Branch and the Wissahickon Stream and what an incredible influence that landscape had on him. Certainly, Thoreau and his trip down the East Branch and the writing of the Maine Woods, the Wabanaki people. This is a very, very special part of their mythology. The fact that it's a northern, intact northern hardwood forest, and there's a lot of that in Maine, but it is a very special place to see that. There are 60 more species of plants that have been documented on the proposed monument than in Baxter State Park. So it's a more diverse landscape. It plays a huge role in climate change and being a climate refuge as the world becomes warmer. The geologists that identified the plate tectonics realized this on the east branch of the Penobscot in 1952, doing a study for the USDA, which has totally shaped the way we think about the way our Earth was created. So, you know, there's many very significant things that have happened there.
Let's go to Josh in Bangor. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
Just a question. I get the impression when I hear the debate that many of the opponents, they almost assert what seems like a sense of ownership of the land. And I'm just wondering if this is private land, people have concerns that the monument would hinder access. But if the Elliott Plantation or Quimby or whomever wanted to, couldn't they just stop access to the land anyway? I mean, this is their land, right? They can do with it what they want. Are there particular limitations related to that?
Thanks for that question. I think that's something that oftentimes gets overlooked. I mean, and it is our property. It's private, and we can do with it what we please. And we could place rules and restrictions on them as we see fit. Once the land is donated to the American people and the Park Service, then it becomes a public conversation, and there's very specific things that agency does to promote the landscape. And right now, it's up to the decision of a few people that sit on our board.
Charlie Prayer, are there concerns that turning it into from this privately owned conservation plot to a monument would further restrict uses, recreational uses?
Well, you know, again, going back to the fact that there would be those decisions in many part would be made by a group of individuals more in Washington, D.C. than some type of local advisory board. And, of course, if it proceeds further, you know, I'll just mention councillor from Millinocket, town councillor Paul Santacondro, mentioned yesterday in his presentation is that going back to a study done by the National Park and Conservation Association in 1988, they described Baxter Park and the surrounding lands as a significant area to be considered for a future national park unit. And in that, they talked about how they would do this. And this is still a lot of concerns over that there's, and by the way, that was headed up by Director Jarvis's brother, Destry Jarvis, who is the current National Park Service Director, John Jarvis's brother. And these things just keep popping up, and there's a lot of concerns. Let me go back. I'm a little interested because I know both of the callers who have called in so far, both of them on the opposite side of the issue than I am. Of course the Quimbys own the land, or Elliottsville Plantation. Miss Quimby owns the land. And to some degree, as landowners, they have the right to do what they want to. But all of us who own land in the unorganized or any place else still have to go through a variety of rules and regulations as to what we can do with it. Technically, this land is under tree growth. Under tree growth, they're supposed to have a forest management plan. I'm not sure that they do.
No, we absolutely
forest
do.
Management
we have
plan
had one
in reference
since we
to how you're going to harvest, how you're going to harvest timber, because that was the purpose of the tree growth tax law when it was passed, was that you'd gotten this tax break because you were going to supply wood fiber to the economy. And basically what you're proposing is not having this land in any fashion be worked. So there could be some questions in reference to whether it qualifies to be under the tree growth tax break. But I do think that all landowners have responsibilities, whether you're in the unorganized or community. You cannot just do anything that you want to on your property. In the unorganized territories, for those areas that have been opened up to development, usually around a body of water, there are restrictions as to how close they can be. They have to be 100 feet off from the water. All kinds of rules and restrictions against people, even though they own the land.
All right, we're going to take another quick break when we come back. More of your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Silly's and Silly's with a Twist in Portland's East End. Open at 11 Wednesday through Friday, 9 on the weekends, with vegan and gluten-free options, sillys.com. And Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Broadcasting's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Ahead of a high-level meeting between the U.S. and China, we'll hear from a top U.S. diplomat on the complicated issues facing the two nations.
What the Chinese have been doing in the South China Sea, it's alarmed the neighbors, and the net effect has been to drive Southeast Asian countries into America's arms.
That's next time on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 o'clock. And join us at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling for World Affairs. Today's speaker, former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis. He'll talk about Greece and its future. That's World Affairs, coming up after Maine Calling here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the debate over the North Woods. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Paul in Bucksport. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to, first of all, thank Mr. St. Clair and Ms. Quimby for their magnificent gift. I also am flabbergasted at the resistance to this gift. I have yet to hear one solid reason why they shouldn't be able to do this. I know a lot of people want it the way it was. Well, I'm afraid those days are over with. And they also don't want restrictions. Well, like you, the previous caller from Bangor just said, they own the land, not us. And they can do what they want, you know, subject to what Mr. Gray said about restrictions. However, they could also make it a Plum Creek, like the development there. They could do a lot of things and in fact, totally restrict the land. So I am very frustrated that the locals seem to be so resistant on some employment. I own land up there, property up there, and I also spend a lot of time up there, and I would love to see this thing as a park. And thanks again, Mr. St. Clair.
Well, thanks for saying that. It means a lot. And, you know, I appreciate your comments, and I'll also add that not all locals are resistant to this. As we saw yesterday and as we saw 2 weeks ago in Orono, there's more supporters than opponents. And it really are the same. It's the same few people that have been outspoken against this. And, you know, a lot has changed in these communities, and it's been challenging. And change hasn't always been good. And I am the first to admit that I don't like to change. But the reality is we have to. It has to evolve. And in fact, it's already upon us. And so decisive action is what needs to be taken place here. And it's really positive to see that this debate has turned and the tide has turned, as we said earlier, into more of a discussion of how are we going to implement it and let's start doing it soon.
Charlie Prey, you mentioned earlier in the show that there are issues around the process, the change in the way that this has been taken up, that originally it was a national park proposal that would have had to have been vetted by Congress, and then that changed, and it's been moved now to this monument proposal that can go just directly to the president, who can make that happen through an act of his own. Is that a major issue, and do you think there are opponents who would feel better about it if it had to go through the congressional process?
As I said earlier, I'm not opposed to the federal government. I'm not opposed to the president having the authority under the Antiquities Act, though I do. I would personally, as a political scientist by education, as a person who has served now and currently in local government but also state and federal government, would much prefer to see an open process. I mean, there's a lot of question in reference to how this got into the White House without really hearing from both sides, the political decision. I would like to see any president that's going to make such a decision that instead of having the director of the Park Service, which is the current director, is a career bureaucrat, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but since it's a political decision by the president, there's a lot of questions about the influence. How did Ms. Quimby get on the National Park Foundation? How did, and as Director Jarvis mentioned at the Orono one, is, well, if you got the money, we'd like to have you on the board. And that's part of the problem with a lot of people in America, that it's money buying access. How did Lucas get access to the White House staff to sell their side of the issue without hearing, as a matter of fact, from what I had understood, is that when they mentioned the fact that a lot of local support was there and that the members of various boards of selectmen supported the proposal, that it was never mentioned that the communities had voted in opposition to it. So that closed process of presenting something to a president, making a decision to something that he has never seen. At least Roosevelt was there. At least in a number of those national monuments, presidents or their staff went and visited. There's been nobody from the White House staff that have come up here and talked to the local people on both sides, advocates and supporters. And I have a lot of friends who are supporters of this proposal. A lot of them are in business and they're looking at it for economic purposes to help increase the flow of traffic potentially into their businesses. And like I said, having spent 58 years in tourism, we like a heavy flow of traffic. But I do think that the process is somewhat shady.
All right. I'll let you respond to the shady part there.
I don't, you know, I'm not going to go into a conspiracy theory about how my mother got on a board of directors or how I have access to the White House. You know, so I made an appointment. There's a website that you can go and make an appointment to speak with the Council for Environmental Quality, CEQ, and that's the White House's arm for environmental work. And they members of that team have been to the property, and Director Jarvis is a political appointment, so that he is a member of the Department of Interior, and he's been to the property several times, and you know I trust his judgment because he has been a part of the Park Service for 40 years. I mean, he's an expert, so I don't find it shady at all.
But why the strategic change away from the park toward this monument?
We felt like it was a great opportunity to celebrate the National Park System's 100th anniversary in 2016. And so last year, we had drafted legislation. I spoke with all of our members of the Maine congressional delegation and asked if it met their concerns. They said it did. And I asked then if they would introduce that legislation, and they didn't feel comfortable at the time. And so we told them, okay, we're going to go and try to see if the president will create a national monument. Now, I have not met with the president and asked him to do this, but certainly have gone through the proper channels, speaking with Park Service, Department of Interior, and CEQ, to introduce them to the concept. And they've been very encouraging, and that's the process that these things take. So everything has been very transparent.
Darby from Facebook writes, it seems a lot of people in opposition to the park comes from dislike and distrust of Roxanne Quimby. Is that part of the tension here? Do you feel, Lucas, is this about some personal stuff?
Well, I think it's easier to make it personal to create sort of an adversarial situation, you know, and this isn't about an individual. This isn't about one person. This is about a really incredible landscape that could be gifted to the American public that would protect this very, very special place, build outdoor recreational infrastructure, and at the same time increase the economy to local communities that desperately need it. So it's not about Roxanne Quimby or someone's like or dislike. Well, that's what the opposition has continually tried to do, including the governor and Congressman Poliquin yesterday, describing us as mean and vengeful people. And, you know, I don't think that's the case.
And is Charlie had mentioned concerns about an agenda of getting a toehold here. First this parcel, and then we'll grow it into the original vision of a $3 million park.
So there's just no way that could possibly happen. It's surrounded by towns on all sides, and the Penobscot land to the north and Baxter to the west. And so we would have to take over towns and take over a 210,000-acre state park that is very specifically deeded to be treated a certain way. So there's just no way that it could expand to 3.2 million acres. And people continue to bring that up because it was a really heated exchange back in the early 90s when they talked about restore. I'm opposed to a 3.2 million acre national park as well, and I've said that multiple times. It's just there's no way it'll work, and because it was so controversial, people like to bring it back up as potential.
Yeah, Charlie?
Keith, let me say, first of all, I've known Lucas since I guess he was about 2 years old, his mother was one of my constituents back in the early days of my political life. Roxanne Quimby is a significant success story of a woman that went through what she went through and after the situation of establishing, making products. I remember when she first started out doing that and worked in the old Guilford Library with a group of women making their products and stuff. And obviously a great success story. And she probably did get off a little bit on the wrong foot when she first participated with Restore and some of the things that she said. She's apologized for those. And no way do I want to make this personal. I do not believe that Lucas or Elliottsville Plantation at this time has a bigger desire for a larger area, but I do believe the National Park Service does. It's something they've been looking at for well over 50 years, as a matter of fact, even longer than that, because that's why Percival Baxter created Baxter State Park, because the federal government was looking at it back in the 1930s. These individuals, and as I pointed out, the study that was done in 88 about trying to take over Baxter Park as well as part of the National Park Service still exist, and there are people at this national group in Washington, D.C., who cares little about Maine other than this desire to have this huge, significant block of land sitting up there that they can say that they're part of.
What about this idea, and people have suggested, why not just give this land to the state of Maine and have it be part of Baxter or a state park? Was that considered?
Yeah, absolutely. We looked at a state park, a national forest, a wildlife refuge. We looked at hosts of different options, but really it came down to the economics. You know, there's 35 state parks in Maine. I think most Mainers would be hard-pressed to name five or six of them, and I think most people in the country could name five or six national parks pretty easily. You know, people don't come to visit state parks. People don't come to visit wildlife refuges or even national forests like they do national parks. There's a reason why they're on the cover of every newspaper or every travel magazine this summer. You know, they're very, very special places that draw people from all over the world. You know, they get about 100 million more visitors than all the Disney resorts worldwide. So it's a very, very strong brand.
Let's go to Jeff in Orono. Hi, Jeff. Really briefly, if you can. We're short on time.
Sure. I'm both a conservationist and a sports person, and I'm not particularly thrilled with the history of the industrial forest in preserving our sporting heritage. I think if one looks at what happened to the deer yards in the past decade and a half, we shouldn't look to the forest products industry as the preserver, life preserver of our wildlife heritage. And so I'd ask both gentlemen to talk about how their vision of conservation for this land contributes to Maine's sporting heritage.
Charlie, you want to go first? Keep it to a minute.
Sure. I served 12 years on the Inland Fisheries and Wildlife Committee when I was first in the legislature, and I'd have to say I wasn't a big favorite of the paper industry because of the amount of restrictions and stuff that I was willing to support. I do think the forest practice management plan needs to be looked at. I do think that we need to look at the changing climate situation and the changing forest resources that we have. It is migrating north, the softwood, and we need to have an economic plan as to how the state is going to be able to use these natural resources for its future economy.
Lucas.
And, you know, this national park will have access for hunting and for fishing and protecting the resource that will be the primary objective. So
When, you meant monument, didn't you?
Yeah. So when we think about what it will do for the sportsman heritage in Maine, it will be celebrated, and it will be also protected into perpetuity. There's the large landowners are still private landowners and can make decisions based on their own interests and goals, while this would be part of the American public's, and that access will be provided forever.
There are some things that you both agree on, right? That is, you both want to, I guess, have a vision for this area. You both think it's beautiful. Do you think you'll be able to come together on this?
I think once that it happens, there'll be a lot of coming together as we build out the infrastructure and make a plan for the communities. I think that's really, in some ways, the division over this proposal have kept people from working together. And as the momentum has grown in support of it, I think it's clear that the majority of Mainers are supportive. And once this happens, then there'll be a great opportunity for the town council of Millinocket and individuals from around the region to come together and put together a plan for how they're going to deal with the future, something, frankly, that should have been done a long time ago.
We'll have to see what the president does. Thank you both for joining us today. We're out of time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Charles Pray is a Millinocket town councilor and former president of the Maine Senate. Lucas St. Clair is president of Elliottsville Plantation, Inc., and he leads the efforts to donate his family's land. John Keimel and Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Sidney Campbell answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation with the host of NPR's On Point, Tom Ashbrook. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.